It's September 7th, 2016, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's science and technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I am Ryan Ozawa, and we will, after some quick Apple talk, look ahead on the local tech calendar. Shem Lawler from Blue Planet Foundation is going to tell us about the upcoming first-ever electric island drive. Then Fiona Langenberger is going to come from PacIUS to tell us about the PacIUS program, new website, and, of course, the IUCN Congress.
And, of course, finally, after the break, we'll talk with Will Haynes and Jason Graham, both researchers developing programs to save native species of butterflies and bees. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions as part of the conversation. And, of course, you can call us or tweet us after the break.
Now, before we get started, we should talk a little bit about that fruit company's announcement this morning. It's essentially the largest product announcement of the year for tech companies, mobile companies. Apple and its iPhone 7 updated watch. Anything in particular stand out for you, Mr. iPhone user?
So, all the lead up and the rumors, and I thought, this is not going to be a big change from the iPhone 6. But then when they announced the iPhone 7 Plus with the two cameras, and one with wide angle and one with zoom, and one and having that sort of that effect where you can shoot a person's face and have the background blur. I thought, wow, that is super cool. Yeah, and the price differential is probably only about $100 between the 7 and the 7 Plus.
Right, right.
So I'm kind of tempted.
Now, we are in a radio station, and I'm sure among our colleagues here there are strong opinions about the decision to remove the headphone jack from this device. Do you have a stance on it?
Well, I kind of am along the lines of, I think wireless is the way to go. And it was reassuring that they came out with the AirBuds. And hopefully the AirBuds really have some, level of performance where the audio quality is going to be as good as a wired connection. So I'm hopeful.
Well, we'll give that a shot. I mean, Bluetooth is not always the most reliable. It does come with an adapter, though, for everybody who was screaming and crying. You can still plug in your old-fashioned headphones.
Well, and the thing is, they didn't really say the price of the AirBuds, right?
$159.
Oh, $150. Well, that's going to boost the whole package up by $159.
Yes. All right, Apple Watch, we both wear them. They're not really changing the look of it, making it more waterproof. They're adding a GPS so you can finally jog and run and track your movements without having to carry that darn phone around. They're keeping the first Series 1 watch around so they can lower that price to $269. But this new Apple Watch is, again, more waterproof, more active, and has a few more tricks up its sleeve. They're even putting the new processor in the old one, though, so I think it's a pretty good deal for people who haven't yet given that a shot.
Yeah, and for the people that already have the Apple Watch, it'd be kind of a tough, I think, decision to actually upgrade to the 2.
Not.
And since you're going to get the Watch OS 3 anyway, that's going to make your watch a little bit more performance enhanced, I guess. I think, it's probably good to just stick with the Series 1.
Yeah. All right. All right. Gadget talk out of the way. What's coming up on the calendar, Bert?
Well, we've got the Hawaii Tourism Authority is hosting the tourism conference focusing on Hawaii's travel future. And that's coming up on September 26th through the 30th. This year, besides topics about the global tourism market, there's several Hawaii tech companies that will be featured during the Tech Hub section of the exhibition space. And, of course, those include our favorites, Ibis, Outdoor Junkies, Activator, and Oceanit. So we'll have them all at the Tech Hub during the tourism conference. So if you want to find more information, you can go to HawaiiTourismConference.com.
That's an easy one to remember.
Yes, I will put that up on the show notes if you forget. Of course, first up, we want to welcome Shem Lawler from the Blue Planet Foundation. And he's here to give us the latest on the Electric Island Drive, the first time ever. Welcome to the show, Shem.
Thank you, Bert and Ryan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so tell us about what is this Electric Island Drive all about?
So we wanted to arrange a kind of an event to celebrate National Drive Electric Week, which starts on September 10th and runs through the 19th, and also to kind of coordinate it at the same time with the IUCN conference.
Mm-hmm.
So the 10th is the last day of the IUCN and the first day of National Drive Electric Week, so that we chose the 10th as the day to do a drive. Basically, it's going to be a caravan-style event where we've invited EV owners from around the island, electric vehicle owners from around the island, to come and participate. We're going to have them meet at several locations, one on the windward side and then three downtown. And then they're going to kind of pull out at coordinated times, so they all kind of merge onto Kalakaua Avenue and drive through Waikiki at the same time, and then they're going to proceed up to KCC, where we're going to have a reception afterwards, kind of EV party.
Now, Blue Planet Foundation and its focus on energy, renewable energy, sustainability. You have done electric vehicle drives before, but this one is definitely more, sounds like more of a public spectacle, more like a parade.
Right, exactly. So we do a lot of events where we invite people to come and test drive electric vehicles, people who don't own them or who are curious about them. Those are fun. Those are pretty effective at helping people to kind of be introduced to electric vehicles. And this one, we kind of wanted to highlight the growth of electric vehicles in Hawaii and kind of create a vision of the future. Our kind of our vision is to have a road filled with electric vehicles, and people can kind of see that that's where we're going.
Well, I know that a good friend of mine just picked up a Tesla Model X. The SUV looks very, very nice. Part of me kind of thinks that it would be an interesting experience to be in Waikiki if you have dozens of electric vehicles going down Kalakaua, rather than hearing buses and trucks and motorcycles and mopeds. It might be kind of almost a little eerie, perhaps, if most of the traffic for a brief period of time are all electric vehicles.
Right, and you raised an interesting point about the noise. We thought about that, and originally we were going to try and close Kalakaua, but because of all the security issues around the ICM, we decided to do it as a caravan style. Which has some logistical challenges. But because of the lack of noise and because of logistical challenges, we bought flags for all the cars. So all the cars will have window flags that kind of announce the event and kind of see what's going on.
How many owners did you go out and contact? I mean, do you have like a Rolodex of all the electric vehicle drivers in town? I mean, there must be thousands of them.
There are there's about 4,600 electric vehicles registered in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 4,600, 3,500, so some odd are on Oahu. So the problem we've had or the challenge has been there isn't any large database that we can reach out to. There is a database, but the...
I mean, it's not like there's a electric car club or something.
Well, there are some groups, but there's nothing large and formal. So we've been working with the dealerships. They have kind of contact lists, and we have a very large network with Blue Planet Foundation through our work.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been announcing it through our network, through social media. So we'll have 50 to 100 vehicles at least at the event on Saturday.
And they have to be 100% electric?
No, so we're inviting anything that's eligible for the electric vehicle license plate. So that would be a battery electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle.
And certainly if you are listening and you have a Prius or you have a Tesla, if you're lucky, and you feel like you need to go run an errand on Saturday, it wouldn't be a bad idea to maybe tool around downtown.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And then, so if anybody wants to come and join the caravan, I mean, where can they go to sign up? Do they have to actually physically go to a website and sign up, or do they call you up, or what's the registration
process? Well, the easiest thing to do would be to go to electricislanddrive.org. We set up that special website. It links to a RSVP page where they can sign up. And then everyone that signs up, we send them, we directly contact them and tell them, give them details about where to go, assign them a drive captain, and give them all the logistics.
Right, there's some coordination that's involved, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, at the end of the drive, I'm sorry, you probably mentioned, is there a rally or an event or anything
we're kind of having an electric vehicle party up at KCC in the parking lot where they have the farmers market every Saturday morning. So we have a big tent. We're going to have a stage, some very short speeches. There's going to be gift bags for all the participants. There'll be some prizes as well. It's going to be pretty laid back, but kind of a fun event.
So the actual drive through Kalakaua is before you get to Kapiolani, KCC, right?
So we're going to have the vehicles meet at their locations at between 12:30 and 1. 12:30 is on the windward side, Kailua Elementary School. And then the downtown locations will have the vehicles meet there at 1 p.m. And then they'll all pull out at about 1:30. And they'll drive through Waikiki and up to KCC by 2 o'clock. And then from 2 to 3 will be the kind of electric vehicle party.
All right. And that's this Saturday. Now, before we let you go, Shem, I mean, Blue Planet Foundation, IUCN, World Conservation Congress, have you been participating, checking it out? Any reactions on this event we're hosting in the United States for the very first time?
Yeah, I think it's a great event. Blue Planet Foundation has been involved. We held a workshop on Sunday about getting all the islands in the Pacific to rally behind the kind of mantra of 100% renewable energy. So that was kind of a fun event. I attended meeting on Monday night as well, with had all the mayors and the governor talking about how they can support and work towards achieving the goals of the Aloha Plus Challenge.
Yeah, sounds good. Sounds good. So, Shem, thanks for joining us.
That was a pleasure.
ElectricIslandDrive.org on this Saturday.
Yeah. Get your Tesla.
Okay, I'll pick one right up.
Okay. Well, next up, we want to welcome Fiona Langenberger, and she's here to tell us about the latest happenings with PAC-IUS, the Ocean Observing System, and, of course, her impressions of the IUCN Congress. Welcome to the show, Fiona.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
It's
appreciate
good to have
it.
We're fans of PAC-IUS, yeah. But it's been a while since we've featured your work. For first of all, it's a fascinating acronym. What does PAC-IUS stand for?
It stands for the Pacific Islands Ocean Observing System, in short, PEC-IUS.
Fantastic. And is it part of that global or a world observing system?
Yeah, we're part of the U.S. Integrated Ocean Observing System. So that's our parent organization. And then there's 11 regional associations, and we're one of them, and we're the one dealing with the Pacific Islands.
Mm-hmm. And you folks are based out of UH?
Exactly. We're based within the School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Mm-hmm. And our region really spans from Hawaii all the way to the U.S. territories and the freely associated states in the Pacific Islands.
And what would you say is the main, product or output of PAC-IUS?
Well, I definitely have to report that we have a new website.
That's great.
So at PAC-IUS.org, so that's PACIOOS.org, we have all of our data available. It's all coastal and ocean information and data and tools. The website features user-friendly and dynamic tools, and that make it, really easy to explore all the data that we have. We try to create something really engaging, because these days, you really have to have an interactive platform for people to like it. Mm. And our user base is very diverse, so we wanted to make sure that, we're getting it right for everyone.
Well, I'm curious about that user base. Mm-hmm. I mean, I visited a few times. It seems like it could be useful to surfers, to fishers, to any member of the community, people who have boats. What is the range of that audience for the PAC-IUS website?
Yeah, our data really is to empower ocean users, agency partners, scientists, resource managers to make well-informed decisions. And you're right, surfers, are really interested in some of the real-time observations that we have. For instance, the wave buoys, mm-hmm. They report every 30 minutes. And for instance, the Waimea wave buoy up on the North Shore is really, really popular throughout the winter months, obviously. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But we also have forecasts. So, for instance, we have a wave inundation model that projects possible wave inundation for the next days. And that's in particular important for the low-lying parts of our region, such as the Marshall Islands.
Now, in terms of the data that you are collecting, is all the the data from sensors that the PAC-IUS has put out there in the ocean?
So we have sensors and buoys and instrumentation out in the field. So that's the real-time observations or near real-time. And then we have the models, so that's numerical modeling. But we also serve information and data from partners. So, for instance, one that comes to mind is the Hawaii tiger shark tracking data. So that's a really popular one. We worked with researchers from the Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology to provide their tiger shark tracks. So it's transparent and available to the public throughout the research period.
Right, and these are based on sensors that they have on the tiger sharks,
yes,
right? And
yes.
You can sort of track them and see where they are.
Yes. Yes, so you can go online and you can track a shark.
Wow, and it's pretty real time. I mean, is
no,
it like,
that one is not. It's so like a, it's not a warning system.
Right, there's a warning right here.
Exactly.
This is not a warning system. But I like how you can pick a shark and there's maybe 14 sharks. There's a lot of sharks here. But they're numbered, though. We got to get some names for these sharks.
Yes. Yeah, we were actually thinking about it would be a neat project maybe with schools to, get names.
Adopt a shark.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's great. So in terms of do you do any sort of what kind of analysis do you do? I mean, you have raw data coming in and you do some kind of numerical analysis and then you provide it to the public. I mean, what sorts of analysis would you be doing?
Well, we're mostly a data provider. So, you know, we collect the data and, you know, for the models, we generate the models. But, you know, there's like other agencies like NOAA's mm-hmm. National Weather Service who actually interprets the data. So we would not put out a warning or an advisory. That's like something that the Weather Service would do. But, you know, we do work closely with them, you know, because it's important to, you know, for them to have the data. And so that's kind of our main mm-hmm. mission. Mm-hmm.
Now, so you mentioned you launched the new look to this Voyager kind of tool that you can use to explore. That was announced on the 30th. And then right before Tropical Storm Madeline and Lester came, and there's a lot of data that you have in terms of the ocean conditions and such. It's very exciting at pacius.hawaii.edu. We also wanted to ask you, though, about the IUCN Congress from your point of view. Have you been able to check it out?
Yeah, I mean, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Like, the fact that this kind of conference comes to Hawaii, that was just amazing. I mean, I'm highly inspired, you know, like, to go back and really motivated to, you know, work on and incorporate, like, some of the things that I've learned during the conference. I attended a workshop that was actually with Bert as one of the speakers.
Of course, he's a huge draw.
It was the Emerging Leadership in Digital Media Conservation
yes.
Campus. And, you know, for me as a communications person, I do appreciate, you know, this continuous learning experience and learning from the experts from the field, like what are like great examples, how to get the word out. In particular now with social media, I mean, it's such a fast moving environment. And yeah, you can't get enough new information. And so that was a really great platform.
Well, you know, and I think in terms of getting it out to the general populace, I mean, those platforms, you know, social media, whether it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, I mean, it really helps to kind of popularize it across the you know, the community.
Yeah, I think like just thinking through like how social media impacted, you know, conservation and science in general, like it made it so much easier to quickly get the word out, you know, like new initiatives that are ongoing, you know, to mobilize people to get out in the field and help. I think it really made a difference throughout the past years.
And it was actually Bert that reminded me that there is the open expo for the public. It's open every day from 11 to 5 and
exactly.
only through the 9th. So
isn't it also on the 10th?
I'm not sure.
Okay, so
I think
for sure it's all the way through the 9th.
And
right?
So if you've been curious about some of these exhibitors, some of these groups showing the work they're doing and how it all connects into this global movement for sustainability, you should definitely go down to the convention center and check it out.
Free,
it
starts
free.
At 11 all the way till 5. There's all kinds of exhibits and you can get some hands-on, and there's some, you know, like I think the NOAA.
The Science on a Sphere.
Science on a Sphere. It's really impressive. And then Google Earth is there and they got some
Google's
pretty
there.
Cool maps.
So one more time though, Fiona, for people who want to check out the PacIUCN website and all this great ocean data, where can they go?
Well, they can go to pacius.org and, you know, you can from there you can explore everything. It's pretty straightforward.
Very good.
Check it out.
Thanks, Fiona, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And of course, we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be joined by Will Haynes and Jason Graham to talk about saving the native Hawaiian Kamehameha butterfly and the yellow-faced bee.
Why is it important to save these native species? Of course, we'd love your questions as part of that conversation. Well, you can give us a call at 941-3689 or toll-free from the Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689.
And of course, we're live in the studio monitoring Twitter. You can reach us at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
This week on Invisibilia, we look at an incredible experiment that took place on an oil rig and how it changed the emotional lives of the men on board.
Had you ever talked this way emotionally with men?
No, that's just not a manly thing.
I'm Elise Spiegel. We are back with a brand new season of Invisibilia from NPR.
This evening at 7, following Counterspin.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, do you love our electoral system?
No, I didn't think so.
So if there were one election idea that you could personally kill off, what would it be?
The idea that we ought to abolish.
The idea that I would like to die.
We need to change the way we currently vote.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Thursday evening at 7, following With Good Reason. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund. which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today are Will Haynes and Jason Graham. Will is a researcher over at the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources and is also the principal investigator for the Department of Land and Natural Resources funded Kamehameha Butterfly Pulelehua Project.
Jason, meanwhile, is also a researcher at UH developing conservation management plans for the critically threatened Hawaiian yellow-faced bee.
And of course, what are the strategies for protecting these species? We'd love to hear your questions and comments. And of course, that number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome you all to Bite Marks Cafe.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, you know, let's start with the state insect, Kamehameha butterfly. And I also want to bring in Christy Kimura because she was very instrumental in getting involved with this. But, well, give us a little history. I mean, where did this all kind of start?
It started, I think, in...
2009?
2009 yeah. when this group of, I think, elementary school students at the time or middle school students petitioned the legislature to officially recognize the Kamehameha butterfly as our state insect because we didn't have an official state insect prior to that. The Kamehameha butterfly has long been sort of an iconic species in Hawaiian entomology, you know. These students... made it their mission to bring it to the public's attention. And then from there, you know, my involvement kind of came from, you know, DLNR wanting to do something about this species and do some, just kind of get sort of a snapshot of, you know, how well is the species doing now and get some data on basically the basic biology of the species.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was doing a little research and found out that, you know, in 2009, that was when the legislation was introduced. And I happened to read some of the testimony and these students from, and it was a Pro Ridge Elementary. They were fifth graders. And I want to welcome Christy Kimura because she was one of the group that actually introduced the legislation. Hey, Christy.
Hello.
Hi. So tell us, Christy, of course, you're not fifth grader anymore. You're a senior. You graduated from Moanalua High School. So give us a little, sort of harken back to that time when you were a fifth grader and your teacher said, hey, I want you guys to, you know, do a little research. What was the challenge put in front of you?
Since I'm only in the fifth grade, I didn't have any... prior experience working with politics.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really know how to go about introducing a bill.
Mm-hmm.
So in our GT class, we learned how to write up a bill, and we met with the legislator and introduced it to them.
So which legislator did you work with?
I'm not too sure.
So did you research like what insect you wanted to select for the possible candidate, the state insect?
We had a list of possible insects and we researched all of them, but we found that the Kamehameha butterfly is the only indigenous species to the Hawaiian Islands.
That's great. And so in terms of seeing it become established as the state insect, I mean, was there any cheers after, you know, the bill was passed? Did your team put up a banner?
Go to the governor's office?
Yeah, how did you celebrate that moment?
Our teacher just told us in class, and then we kind of celebrated on our own.
it wasn't
really well known.
Yeah, so it wasn't like a big deal. Well, Christy, I want to thank you for calling in and sharing that little.
We wanted to hear from one of the young voices shaping our policy.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks,
You're
Christy.
Welcome.
So what I thought was kind of interesting was, well, you know, in terms of getting funding, I mean, isn't having the state INSEC established very helpful toward getting some funding to perhaps save the state INSEC?
Oh, I think so. I mean, anything that sort of raises, you know, a species in the public profile, you know, gets people sort of thinking about it. That's where everything kind of starts in terms of, you know, getting funding, getting, you know, the politicians interested in a project. And I mean, I kind of think of the Kamehameha butterfly as sort of a good, we call them flagship species, where it's a species that the public can really relate to.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we have, you know, over 5,000 species of native insects, and many of those are endangered, many of them are endangered, and mm-hmm. many have gone extinct, mm-hmm. actually. The Kamehameha butterfly, you know, most of those insects are, you know, small and maybe only occur up in the mountains or maybe only in a very restricted site. But the Kamehameha butterfly is one that, you know, people can really, you know, everybody thinks it's a beautiful insect. I mean, being involved in this project, the interest from the public has just been huge, and it's been very inspiring.
That's great.
I definitely want to hear more about the butterfly, and I think we have some callers who have questions about the butterfly. I certainly do. But before we go there, I wanted to hear a little bit from Jason about the yellow-faced bee. Now, I've heard about the Kamehameha butterfly. I have to admit, I was not familiar with a Hawaiian connection to any particular species of bee. So can you help us introduce this insect while I take a look at this wooden plank in front of you?
Sure. That'd be great. thanks, Ryan. So I've been working with the Hawaiian yellow-faced bee. The species that I'm working with is Hylaeus anthracinus. And Hawaii actually has no native honeybees. It only has native solitary bees. Mm. And Hylaeus are endemic to, or the Hylaeus anthracinus and several 60 other species are endemic to the Hawaiian Islands.
Mm-hmm. And so we love when guests bring things. I hope I'm not breaking it. This looks like basically a 2x4.
You could actually hit somebody on the side of the head with
right, with straws perhaps put through it.
Yes.
What am I looking at here?
So this is a 2x4, and we've put straws inserted into it. And I'll show you when you pull these straws out, you can see inside the straw. And this is the ideal space for a bee to nest in. So these solitary bees nest in these spaces.
I mean, it really does look like a straw. I mean, I wouldn't. Right. This must be a very small bee, no?
So, yeah, it's a very small bee. They're about 3 to 5 millimeters, and they go into this entrance. The female will go to the back of the tube, and she'll place some pollen back there, lay an egg on that pollen, and then those eggs will develop into larva, pupa, and then when they emerge out as an adult, wherever they emerge out, they'll go back and try to re-nest into the block.
Oh, so just by having this perhaps hanging from a tree, they find it and say, this feels like home?
Yeah, it's the perfect size hole. So we weren't really sure exactly where they were nesting when I first arrived, but they, after watching them in the field, and I've painted some males on the thorax with a little paint dot so I could see them a little bit better where they were going, and tracked them and found that they were going into stems of plants, coastal plants like naupaka
mm-hmm.
and tree heliotrope, and then also saw some going into coral that has the same size hole.
Ah.
So this is coral rubble here. It's found on the coast, especially the Ki'iwi coastline. So I found some going into the rock, and I wasn't sure if they were actually nesting in the rock or just
exploring.
So I saw some that were sealed. These bees put a seal of a cellophane-type material over it. So I saw some with that material, put it into a Tupperware container, and watched it for several weeks until adults emerged out of that. And I was able to tell that they did actually nest in those holes.
So that's the reason why you brought that piece of coral rock.
I thought you'd be interested in seeing
it. No, that's great. We love you know, little show-and-tell examples. You know, we want to welcome a couple of guests or callers to Bite Marks Cafe. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Hey, aloha. It's Michael Goodrich, originally of Manoa Valley.
Aloha.
You know, I just wanted to share that, you know, it seems to be an indicator that we're having problems with our bees, with our
with our limu, with our lehua trees, and this seems to be a real indicator of a problem with our baseline of the beginning of our ecology. And, you know, do we need to put as much money into these things as we are putting into rail transit and fighting fire ants on the Big Island?
Well, that's a great point. And I think both of our researchers here in the studio could probably comment to, you know, how important that it is to kind of not only preserve the species, but the environment that they live in. Maybe, Jason, I mean, tell us from a coastal standpoint.
Yeah, these bees are right on the coast, and it's very precarious habitat. They're found on the open, the strand, ocean strand. And we actually saw a decline of bees just this past February when the eddy came. The coast, those big waves that brought us the eddy, it was mm-hmm. great for surf, but not so good for the bees. It actually wiped out an entire population at Turtle Bay that we had been monitoring for about a year, and I've been back every week since the eddy, and that the waves came and flooded this jetty out at Turtle Bay, washed out about 80% of the vegetation out there. And since then, I haven't seen any bees on that jetty. So, you know, they are in a very, I guess, fragile ecosystem. And things like climate change and hurricanes, big storm surges could definitely pose a problem. But also we're seeing things like non-native insects, pesticides. Mm. There's pathogens that may be transmitted from some of these non-native insects that are could be depleting these populations of bees.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other things like habitat destruction just from us building and fragmenting the habitat as well.
And certainly we can imagine the role that bees play in pollinating and helping plant species propagate. Will, for the Kamehameha butterfly, I would imagine that they have had a place and still should have a place in our broader ecosystem. But can you kind of describe what perhaps threats face the Kamehameha butterfly, and really what benefits someone who might, apart from really looking beautiful, what benefits the butterfly provides to our environment?
Yeah, sure. So we only have two native butterflies in Hawaii. So, you know, things like the monarch butterfly, the swallowtail butterfly that you see, you know, in residential areas, those are actually not native to mm-hmm. Hawaii. We have the Kamehameha butterfly, and then we have one called the Hawaiian blue, which is a small little actually green butterfly. So those are our only two native representatives in this, you know, in the butterfly group. And butterflies, of course, are flower visitors. And so, you know, any native flowers that were sort of targeting butterflies as their, you know, pollinator, they really were only targeting these two mm-hmm. butterfly species. And so if they decline, then it could have impacts on our native plants. And of course, you know, butterflies start out as caterpillars. Caterpillars are really important in Hawaii. You know, we have all of these native birds, and, you know, even the birds that feed on nectar for most of their lives, when they have fledglings, they're going for caterpillars, they're going for insects. And so our native insects serve as a food source. So even if you hate insects, if you like birds, you know, you want to do something to preserve the insects as
and
well.
I remember monarch butterflies in particular when I was young, living up above Pearl Ridge and chasing them and trying to catch them. But I would agree. It would seem that all butterflies, including these native butterflies, are very scarce now. Do they have pockets of environment where they're still thriving, or are we really just trying to find the stragglers left?
Yeah, I mean, so the Kamehameha butterfly is, you know, it's definitely declining, but as far as native insects go, it's still one of the more widespread insects because it does have a large range as far as, you know, it's found on most of the main Hawaiian islands. But, you know, its range has become more restricted. So as invasive plants have sort of taken over the lowlands, they've pushed the native host plants for the butterfly, including the native mamaki plant, up into the backs of these valleys, you know, up until sort of the mountain forests. And so nowadays, you don't really find the butterfly down in especially in residential areas, whereas you used to find it, you know, it used to be able to be seen in Hilo. And So, now that there are areas where they are thriving. So, you know, when we did this citizen science project, which we'll probably talk about in a little bit, we found that, you know, a lot of the observations were coming from these areas where they're still doing pretty well. So mm-hmm. places like Volcano on the Big Island, where it's a little bit higher elevation, their host plants are still there. And then they're also in these higher elevation areas, some of the threats, the predator threats, are not as abundant. So in Hawaii, we don't have any native species of ants, but we have over 50 species of introduced ants now. And most of those ants are most abundant in residential areas or in lowland areas. There are relatively few ant species that get up into the native forest mm. And the higher elevations.
You know, one of the things that I think Mike was getting at in terms of, you know, the cost or the money being spent to help protect or save the environment that the Kamehameha butterfly survives in. I mean, relatively speaking, is it an expensive endeavor? I mean, what kinds of dollars are we kind of talking about?
Well, I mean, preserving habitats as a whole is really the best way to conserve, you know, this broad diversity of native insects that we have. So, you know, when you have 5,000 species of native insects, you can't be spending, you know, $1 million on each mm-hmm, insect trying mm-hmm. to conserve it. So as far as like conserving general biodiversity, it's about, you know, protecting these habitats as a whole. So, you know, things like fence lines to, you know, keep out goats and pigs. And then, you know, quarantine efforts to keep out more invasive species from coming in that will impact our native insects. And then also, you know, restoring, you know, weed control. So controlling invasive plants that choke out the host plants for these insects. So all of those things do cost money, but by doing those sort of ecosystem level efforts, you're conserving, you know, a broad spectrum mm-hmm, of biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. We have a call to get to, but very quickly, Jason, for the yellow-faced bee, is it also ecosystem protection, which is essentially the primary way that we can support this bee? Or maybe we should all hang these pieces of wood?
Yeah, I definitely think that ecosystem protection is very important. We're also learning a lot that we never knew before about these species. So research is also very important. So we can find out a little bit about the life cycle of these bees. We can kind of key in on what specific problems that they're facing and try to fix those problems as well. And education is also important. Like you said, not a lot of people know about the Hawaiian yellow-faced bee. So it'd be great to get out the word so these people don't accidentally see some little small black bug on their, you know, bushes in the backyard and spray something on them. They're actually should be protected.
Well, you know, we're talking to Jason Graham about the yellow-faced bee and, of course, Will Haynes, who's an expert on the Kamehameha butterfly. And if you got a call or question, feel free to give us a buzz, 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. We want to welcome Mindy to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much, and thank you, Jason and Will, for being here today. My question is, I live in Hilo, and we've been dealing with fire ants for about 4 years now, and where I see fire ants being poisoned, like at our beach parks, I see a lot less of the indigenous species. Is anyone doing any pre-test and then post-test for checking if the fire ant poison is also affecting other species? And is there any way we can eliminate the fire ants like they're trying to eliminate mosquitoes by releasing sterile mosquitoes? Maybe we could eliminate the ants altogether. And how are the ants affecting the butterflies and the bees?
Well, Mindy, that's a great question. You know, you made reference to some indigenous insects. I mean, which indigenous insects are you observing?
What I'm seeing after 3 years of fire ant poisoning at the beach parks is no turtles. The first year, second year, and then now that it's the fourth year, I don't see any fingerlings, no baby fish whatsoever when I go to Onikaka Beach Park now. The baby fish are gone. So I know it's not in regards. I'm propagating crown flowers, trying to help with the butterflies. I've just planted one in a friend's yard the other day. I have three more to go out. But is it futile because of the fire ants?
Well, that's a great question. I mean,
thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Any fire ant opinions here tonight?
I mean, I can't really answer to the effects of the poison on turtles or fish. I do know that, you know, that those pesticides have been tested for vertebrates, and I'm not familiar with the specific ones that they're using over there. I know that for when you're using when you're controlling ants, most times you're using baits, which are designed to target the ant species that you're controlling. So that is one way to sort of minimize what we call non-target effects. So if you're concerned about impacts on native bees, for example, the bees are feeding on nectar of plants. And so they don't come into contact with these baits that you spread in the soil or, you know, around vegetation.
I like that she's planting flowers to help with the butterflies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, one thing that you can do, especially around Hilo, so I mentioned the monarch butterfly is a beautiful butterfly, and a lot of people, you know, are involved with planting crown flower and you know, supporting the populations of the monarch butterfly. But another thing that you can do is plant mamaki, which is a relatively easy plant to grow. It's a native plant. It can be used to make tea, and that is the host plant for the Kamehameha butterfly, which is one of our only endemic butterflies. And so Hilo is actually a great place to do that because that falls within the historical range of the Kamehameha butterfly. Which is generally like windward sides of the islands. The host plants that it uses really like the wetter areas of the islands.
Now, Jason, because of your research and its involvement with coastal areas, do you have any thoughts about non-target effects for our caller in terms of impacts on, I would imagine the answer would be similar, on bees?
So not necessarily with non-target effects, but we do have an ant problem as well that the bees are facing right now. At our site at James Campbell, we're seeing some yellow crazy ants. So it's a different species than the fire ant. But we're looking at a study now to see if we can exclude the ants from these nest blocks by putting a material called Tanglefoot. It's a non-toxic mineral oil, carnauba wax kind of substance that the ants don't like to walk across. So we put that substance on the cords that we hang the blocks from, and it keeps ants from being able to go in and tear out the pollen and the eggs and larvae and things like that and destroy the nests. But we have shown that we have found that the ants are a significant problem for yellow-faced bees, and we are concerned about that. We're just trying to determine what our next step should be, because we don't want to have non-target problems with pest control.
You know, I want to kind of get into, I mean, both of your strategies for developing like a conservation plan and you know, guys, understanding the life cycle and then perhaps, you know, the whole captive rearing process. But, you know, want to hold that thought. We'll be right back after the short break to continue our conversation with both Will Haynes and Jason Graham about saving native insect species, both the bee and the butterfly.
And as you can tell, we love to hear from listeners. You can call 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689. You're listening to Bite Marks Cafe.
It seems like whatever I'm listening to at the time is my favorite. For instance, yesterday I totally loved a Radiolab story that made me feel like I wasn't alone in the world, somebody who'd gone through the same things I had. And then I listened to Wait, Wait and had a driveway moment that I just couldn't leave the car. Aloha, I'm Carol Kahn from Pauilo on the Big Island, and I'm a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Barbara Marks Hubbard, author of Birth 2012 and Beyond. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about humanity's shift to the age of conscious evolution.
Sunday morning at 11. Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Straub Clinic and Hospital and Gourmet Events Hawaii.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa. And we're talking to Will Haynes and Jason Graham about efforts to protect the Kamehameha butterfly and native yellow-faced bee.
And, of course, you can give us a call here. That number is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. And we want to welcome Larry from the Big Island to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a question regarding the butterflies and the plants that they eat. I have stewardship of some very nice dry forest in South Kona, low elevation llama forest. And there's a lot of native butterflies, mostly feeding on mamaki. But there's a new invasive plant in my neighborhood, the balloon plant, which I'd love to get rid of. But I've noticed the butterflies are eating those. Should I save them? I mean, they're very rapidly spreading.
Oh, that's interesting. I was wondering about whether the Kamehameha butterfly had other sort of, host plants it would like to feed on. The balloon plant, I know what that looks like.
So the balloon plant is actually in the milkweed family. So that is a host plant for the monarch butterfly. So the monarch butterfly isn't native to Hawaii, and neither are its host plants. So and the balloon plant can be actually invasive, as you pointed out, in dry forest areas. So I wouldn't have any, qualms about getting rid of the balloon plant. The Kamehameha butterfly, it is, as an adult, it's fairly generalist. So it basically will visit, flowers of many different species. But it also visits the sap flows on, say, like koa trees. So if a koa tree has a wound in the branch, the butterfly, that sap will start flowing and start fermenting. And the butterflies really love that fermenting. I mean, it's almost like beer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just flock to it.
Butterfly beer.
Yeah, it's like a butterfly bar. and so that's where they kind of congregate. And so, the butterflies themselves, as adults, they can feed on, a variety of things. But the caterpillars are very, very specific to only plants in the nettle family. So that is the most common one is mamaki.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, that's a useful plant also for people because you can make tea out of it. And then the other host plants are things like olona, opuhe. These are more restricted host plants, and you generally only find them in sort of, wetter areas. I wouldn't usually find them in dry forest environments.
Well, right, so no loss of the no love lost for the balloon plant.
Yeah,
no,
so Larry,
so
that's
go
a
ahead.
Great,
yeah,
great question.
You
have
my blessing.
And you got the blessing of the PhD in the house, and so you can pull out all those balloon plants in your backyard. So great, thanks Larry for calling us. And so in terms of the, the environment for the yellow-faced bee, again, you were re-emphasizing the fact that this is the only native bee. So if we were to see a little black bee that has a yellow face, I mean, that is the only native. I mean, and do they have a stinger?
So the females do have stingers, but they can't really they aren't known to sting. They're not defensive of their nests like honeybees would be. I've actually held them and, haven't been stung. I've held them off of flowers and had no problems being stung by them. There are reports of people having them maybe caught behind, caught underneath a sleeve or something like that and been stung. But it's pretty uncommon.
They're not aggressive, it doesn't sound
They're not aggressive at all, no. And there is actually, so there's no other species of native bee. There's no native bumblebees. There's no native carpenter bees, no native honeybees, just the native yellow-faced bees here in Hawaii.
Now, we would we mistaken those for any other type of insect that might look similar? I mean,
they look almost wasp-like or, a small fly. And I have some pictures you can check out on facebook.com/Hylaeus. That's H-Y-L-A-E-U-S. And we also have other information online. You can look up the picture of Hylaeus or Hawaiian yellow-faced bees. Mm,
sounds great. So we want to also take care of some of our callers calling in. You know, we love the fact that you're interested in this topic. Dana from Maui, thanks for joining Bite Marks Cafe.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, good. What's your question?
It's a pretty simple one. I've been wanting to raise butterflies for a few years, and I need to know where to go and who to talk to so I can start in the Lahaina area.
Fascinating.
And Dana, were there any particular butterflies? Are you interested in the native?
Obviously.
You know, the native, yeah. You know, especially that. The monarch looked like we got a few of those hanging around.
Sure.
And I think we can use more, you know. I know somebody up country grows them or, you know, raises them, but down here I have no info. So if I could get some info.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, yes. Yeah, well. So, I mean, one thing about the Kamehameha butterfly in particular, it, you know, it doesn't really like these real dry areas. So, you know, the leeward side of Maui, unless you're kind of up against the mountains up, you know, back in a valley, the Kamehameha butterfly probably won't do that great. But there is another native species of butterfly called the Hawaiian blue, and that one feeds on a plant called a'ali'i and also on koa. And that those are both plants that you can find at native nurseries on Maui. I know there are several nurseries over there that grow
it. For the Hawaiian blue.
Huh. And that's one that, you know, I think people could start bringing back into residential areas. It's a little more common than the Kamehameha butterfly, but it's really beautiful. It's smaller. It's this iridescent green color. I have a picture of it here, but you can't see that on the
we'll
radio.
We'll put that on our website.
It looks pretty nice to me, yeah.
But yeah, so those ones do better in drier areas. So actually, I mean, we've seen it on Kaho'olawe, which has been pretty...
That's, you know, pretty dry.
Yeah, it's pretty dry, and it's had its challenges over the years. But these butterflies have managed to, you know, as people have outplanted their native host plants, they've come back. So that's one that I think people could bring back into their backyards, mm-hmm, pretty easily.
Excellent.
And then, yeah, of course, you have the non-native butterflies, but we like to focus on the native ones here.
Well, we want to welcome Roby from the Big Island to Bite Marks Cafe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. I have a question about the yellow-faced bee, and I was curious as to whether or not the yellow-faced bee is susceptible to some of the same pests that affect regular honeybees, things like the varroa mite and the small hive beetle that Hawaiian beekeepers have been dealing with over the last few years. Have you noticed that as being, yellow-faced bees been affected, by these pests? And I can take my answer off the air.
Great. Excellent question.
Great question. Yeah, how does that? Yeah, how does the varroa mite affect the native yellow-faced bee?
Great, thanks for that call. So the varroa mite is more specific to the honeybee. We don't see that crossing over to the yellow-faced bee. And same with the small hive beetle. Those are pests inside the honeybee colonies that are really difficult for beekeepers to control. However, there are some pathogens that we think may be crossing over from honeybee and other introduced bees to the yellow-faced bee. Some of these pathogens are things that varroa mites carry, like deformed wing virus is carried from honeybees. And it seems that when honeybees visit certain flowers, and say the yellow-faced bee also visits the same flowers, that there's a potential for crossover mm-hmm. and that pathogen. It can cause the bee to develop twisted wings, so they aren't ever able to fly when they come out as adults. And there's other things like American foul brood, European foul brood, Nosema virus. There's many bacterial and fungal viruses that can be passed from bee to bee, and we're concerned that some of these introduced bees may be passing those along.
Mm-hmm. Now, the caller did talk about, you know, what he could do to raise or help foster butterflies. So, Will, I mean, is there a captive breeding program for the Kamehameha butterfly? Since it does sound like they're a little picky in terms of what they eat and where they live, is there a concerted effort to increase that population?
Yeah, so great question. So, you know, our project kind of started out with research first into, you know, figuring out, okay, where is this butterfly still currently, you know, doing well? And then from that, we created a map of sort of the suitable habitat around the Hawaiian Islands. And so which areas of the islands are they most likely to thrive in? And then our next stage in the project was, we're working on Oahu, and what we do is we raise the butterflies and the caterpillars in the lab. And I have a student, Colby Maeda, who's from Hilo originally. He is studying the predation and parasitism of the caterpillar stages and the egg stages of the butterfly. So what he does is he puts the eggs and the caterpillars out in the field. He leaves them out for 3 days, and then he comes back and sees, okay, what has happened to the caterpillar. Mm-hmm. And some of them he's protecting from birds, some of them he's protecting from ants, and some of them are just open to everything. And so what he does is he looks at the disappearance rates between those different groups, and he can kind of infer, okay, birds are having this effect, ants are having this effect, and we're doing that at different sites around the island. And so then we have, you know, that sort of data to add to the mix. And then the next step, which we're just starting now, is we're focusing our efforts on rearing the butterfly for reintroduction. Mm. And so there's several sites that we've identified that, you know, the host plants are there. There's been restoration efforts at the site. And we think that the butterfly should do well there, but the butterfly hasn't recolonized on its own. And so what we're going to do is release a whole bunch of chrysalises of the butterfly. And then we're hoping that when the butterflies emerge in the site, they might fly off for a while, but then we're hoping they'll come back to that site and lay their eggs, and then we'll establish a population there. So that is our next plan. We have a new facility that is focusing on the captive rearing of native insects. So not just the Kamehameha butterfly, but also some of our federally endangered species. And that's funded by the Department of Fish and Wildlife Service and matching funds from DLNR. And so it's kind of exciting. You know, we haven't really done this with insects before, but that's our next part of the project.
Well, I hope we can get updates on how that's going and where those releases might be, or maybe that's not something you would share, but how they're going, definitely keep us posted.
Well, Jason, I mean, where can people find out more about the yellow-faced bee?
So that's the DLNR.hawaii.gov/ecosystems has all the information from DLNR's Hawaii Invertebrate Program, and we're going to put more information about the yellow-faced bees there.
Excellent.
Well, you know, there's so many questions and so many, great callers that called in, and so much more information that we wanted to share, but we've kind of run out of time.
We'll put as many links as we can on our website at bitemarkscafe.org.
Well, Will Hayes is working to protect the Kamehameha butterfly, and of course, Jason Graham is developing conservation management plans for the native yellow-faced bee, and we want to thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you, guys.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll talk to crew members of the recent 12-month high seas mission.
And of course, if you missed any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email us at feedback@bitemarks.org. And of course, you can always find us on Twitter. I'm at bitemarks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And of course, we'll leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a band called Morgan Dell and a song called I Don't Want to See What's Happening Outside. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.